Part 2. Attrition. Chapter 11. Hidden. Sacrifice. Cages. The caverns were deep inside the canyons of a rocky and forbidding landscape that the Dagonetti called the Blade Cut. From the ground, the real meaning of the name wasn't clear, but up high, when glimpsed through the lenses of one of the aerial drones the rebels had captured, it was obvious. The Blade Cut was a massive ravine that moved easterly across the stone wilderness beyond the capital, the shape of it like a giant axe wound in the surface of the landscape. There were no roads, nothing but animal trails and half-hidden hunting routes that meandered into sharp gullies which concealed the mouths of the cave network. Thousands of years ago, this had been the site of the first Dagonet colony, where the new arrivals from Terra had huddled in the gloom while their planet-forming technologies, now lost to history, had worked to make the world's harsh environment more habitable for them. The rebels had retaken the old halls of stone, secure in the knowledge that deep inside nothing would be able to dislodge them, short of bombing the hills into powder. Jenica Solm walked through the meandering tunnels, her face concealed in the depths of her hood, passing chambers laser cut from the rock, ragged chainmail curtains hanging over their entrances, others closed off behind heavy impact welded hatches. Inside the caves, everything was in a permanent twilight, with the only constant the watery glow of bioloom pods glued to the stone ceiling at random intervals. Capra's people, some of them warriors, many more civilians, and even children, passed her as she walked on. Solm glimpsed snatches of the everyday life of the Resistance through gaps in the curtains or past open doors. She saw Bay and a few others surrounding a chart table piled high with paper maps. Across the way, a makeshift armory full of captured PDF weaponry. A skinny cook who looked up at her in the middle of stirring a huge iron drum of thick soup. Refugees clustered around a brazier, and nearby, a pair of children playing, apparently ignorant of the grim circumstances. The latter was no surprise to her. The rebels did not have much choice about where their people could go to ground. Further on, she saw a side chamber that had been converted into a drab approximation of an infirmary, right beside a workroom where figures in shadow were bent over a jury-rigged device trailing wires and connectors. Solm detected the familiar odour of chemical explosives as she moved on. A hatch was creaking shut as she approached, and she turned to see. As it closed, one of Capra's men gave her a blank look from within. Over his shoulder, she saw a bloodied trooper in clan colours tied to a chair, a moment before he disappeared out of sight. She paused and heard footsteps behind her. Solm turned and saw a pair of refugee children approach, eyes wide with fear and daring. They were both grimy, both in shapeless fatigues too big for them. She couldn't tell if they were boys or girls.
"Hey,"
said the taller of the two.
"The Empress sent you, right?"
She gave a nod.
"In a way."
There was awe in their expressions.
"Is he like he is in the Picts? A giant?"
Solm managed a smile.
"Bigger than that, even."
The other child was about to add something, but an adult turned the corner ahead and gave them both a stern look.
"You know you're not supposed to play down here. Get back to your lessons."
They broke into a run and vanished back the way they had come. Solm turned to study the man.
"Are you looking for something?"
he asked warily.
"I'm just walking," she admitted. "I needed a moment to think."
He pointed past her, blocking her path.
"You should probably go back."
The man seemed hesitant, as if he wasn't sure he had the authority to tell her what to do. The execution force fit strangely among the Freedom Fighter group. In the weeks that had passed since they liberated the prison camp in the city, Solm and the others had gained a kind of guarded acceptance, but little more. Under Kell's orders, each of them had turned their particular skill sets towards aiding the rebel cause. Tariel's technical expertise was in constant demand, and Coyne showed a natural aptitude for teaching combat tactics to men and women who had, until recently, been farmers, teachers, and shopkeepers. Meanwhile, Iota and the Garantine would go missing for days at a time, and the only evidence of their activities would be intercepted reports from the communication network, stories of destroyed outposts or whole patrols eviscerated by ghostly assailants. As for her brother, he kept his distance from her, working with Capra, Bay, and Grohl on battle plans. Solm did her part too, but as the days drew on, it disturbed her more and more. They were helping the rebels score victories, not just here, but through other resistance cells all across the planet. But it was based on a lie. If not for the arrival of the assassins on Dagonet, the war would have been over. Instead, they were bolstering it, infusing fresh violence into a conflict that should have already petered out. The Venonum was precise in what she did, surgical and clean. Collateral damage was a term she refused to allow into her lexicon, and yet here they were, their presence more damaging to the locals than the guns of the nobles. The man pointed again.
"Back that way,"
he repeated, dispelling her moment of reverie. Solm realized that he was trying to hide something.
"No," she said. "I think not."
Before he could react, she pushed past him and followed the turn of the narrowing corridor as it dropped into a shallow slope. The man reached for her robes to stop her, and she tapped a dot of liquid onto the back of his hand from one of her wrist dispensers. The effect was immediate. He went pale and fell to the ground, the muscles in his legs giving out. The corridor opened up into another cavern, this one wide and low. In the middle of the dimly lit space, there was a thermal grate throwing out a warm orange glow. Surrounding it were rings of chairs, some scattered cushions and salvaged rugs. A knot of people were there, crowded around an older woman who held an open book in her hand. Solm had the impression of interrupting a performance in mid-flow. The older woman saw the assassin, and fear crossed her expression. Her audience were a mix of all kinds of people from the camp. Two of them, both fighters, sprang to their feet and came forwards with threats in their eyes. Solm raised her hands to defend herself, but the old woman called out,
"No, stop! We'll have no violence."
"Milady,"
began one of the others, but she waved him to silence, and, with visible effort, she drew herself up. Solm saw the echoes of a lifetime of grace and fortitude there in the old woman's face. She pushed through the ring of people and faced her interloper.
I was Lady Astrid Sinope. I'm not afraid of you."
Solm cocked her head.
"That's not true."
Sinope's aristocratic demeanor faltered.
"No. No, I suppose it is not."
She recovered slightly.
"Ever since Bay told us you were on Dagonet, I knew that this moment would come. I knew one of you would find us."
"One of us?"
"The Emperor's warriors," she went on. "Capra said you were the instruments of his will. So come then. Do what you must."
"I don't understand,"
Solm began, but the old woman kept talking.
"I ask only that you show mercy to my friends here."
Sinope held up the heavy book in her hands.
"I brought this to Dagonet. I brought it here, to the Resistance, when I fled the treachery of my former noble clan. If anyone must suffer because of that, it should be me alone."
Her eyes glittered with unspent tears.
"If I must beg you, I will. Please do not hurt them because of me."
No one spoke as Solm stepped past the two warriors and took the book from the old woman's trembling hands. She read aloud the words on the page.
"The Emperor protects."
"We only seek solace in his name,"
said Sinope, her voice falling to a whisper.
"I know that it is forbidden to speak openly of him and his divine ways, but we do so only among ourselves.
We do not proselytize or seek out converts.
She clasped her hands.
We are so few. We take in only those who come to us of their own free will. We have hurt no one with our beliefs.
Solm ran her fingers over the pages of dense, solemn text.
You are all followers of the Laetitia Divinitatis. You believe the Emperor is a living god. The only god.
Sinope nodded.
And I will die with that belief, if that is what is required. But promise me I will be the only one. Please.
She understood finally.
I have not come to purge you,
Solm told them.
We did not even know you were here.
There was a strange, giddy sense of events shifting around her.
But you were sent from Terra, said one of the men.
Not for this, said the Venenum.
Turning to meet Lady Sinope's gaze, raising her arm as she did so, and drawing back her cuff.
And until this moment, I was not certain why.
Solm showed them a small golden chain clasped around her wrist, a charm dangling from it in the shape of the Imperial Aquila.
But now I have an inkling.
She's one of us, said the man. She believes.
Sinope's expression became one of joy.
Oh, child, she said. He sent you. He sent you to us.
Solm returned the book to her and nodded. Kel looked up as the men boiled into the central chamber in a rush of energy and jubilation, weaving through the scattered clumps of hardware and containers, the groups of people who stopped and smiled to see them returning. They still had the smell of cordite, wood smoke, and exertion on them. He scanned the group with a practiced eye and saw they had all come back, and only with a few minor injuries. The squad leader, an ex-pilot named Jeddah, came over to where Capra was standing at a vox console and enveloped him in a bear hug.
It's done, said Capra.
Oh, it's more than done,
Jeddah laughed, the rush of battle still there in his voice. His men shared the moment and laughed with him.
Tariel's information was dead on. We blew out the supports for the bridge and the whole cargo train went down. Hundreds of Klanner troops, a dozen fan jeeps and armored GEVs, all of it, scrap, at the bottom of the Redstone River. Oh, they'll feel that, snorted one of the others. The nobles will be tasting blood tonight.
Capra turned and gave Kel a nod.
Thank your man for me. In fact, thank them all. A month ago, I would never have thought I'd be saying this, but we actually have them on the defensive. The data and guidance you provided us has enabled the Resistance to make coordinated strikes all over the planet. The nobles are reeling.
The mistake they made was their arrogance, said Coyne, wandering up to the group.
The men parted to let the Calidus come closer. They were all unnerved by the bland, unfinished cast of the assassin's neutral features.
They believed they had won, and lowered their guard. They didn't expect you to hit back in synchrony. You've put them off balance.
We'll help you keep up the pressure, Kel told the Resistance leader. All we've done so far is show you how to find the cracks in their armor. You need to keep widening them until they break.
Jeddah nodded to himself.
We didn't lose a single man tonight. And we keep this up, the commoners who haven't committed will side with us.
He grinned at Kel.
At this rate, your fleet might get here and find it has nothing to do.
We can only hope, said Coyne, drawing a look from the Vindicare.
Capra!
Bay crossed the chamber at a jog.
Grosbeck!
Kel saw the grim-faced freedom fighter following her, unfurling his overhood and cloak. He had a scuffed carryall over one shoulder.
From the capital, said Jeddah. We made a lot of noise tonight, Terek. Did they hear it back there in the towers?
His triumphant mood rolled against the other man's stony countenance and rebounded without effect.
They heard it all right, said Grohl.
He dropped the carryall on a crate being used as a makeshift table and threw off his robes with an irritable shake.
The governor made a broadcast over all the communications channels. A declaration, he called it.
The group fell silent. Kel saw the moment radiate out across the cavern to every person within earshot.
Let's see it then, said Capra.
Grohl opened the case and produced a memory spool, The commercial kind that any core world civilian home of moderate means possessed.
One of our contacts recorded this off the public watch wire. It's repeating in a loop at the top of each hour.
Jeddah went to take it from him, but Grohl didn't give it up.
Perhaps you should look at this somewhere more private.
Capra considered that for a moment, then shook his head.
No. If it's on the wire, then everyone else knows about it. Our people should too.
Jeddah took the spool and inserted it into a hololithic reader. With a buzzing hum, the device projected the ghostly image of a man in heavy dress uniform, a braided cap upon his head. He was standing before a lectern, and Kell noticed that it bore the sigil of an open, slitted eye, the symbol of the Sons of Horus.
Governor Nykron, said Jeddah with a sneer. I wonder where he recorded this, cowering in the basement of his mansion. Quiet, hissed Grohl. Listen.
Kell watched the hololith carefully as the governor began with empty pleasantries and vapid words of praise for his puppet masters in the noble clans. He read the politician's expressions, for a moment imagining he was seeing that face down the sights of his Exodus long rifle. Nykron had all the look about him of a desperate man. Then he turned to the important part of the announcement.
Citizens of Dagonet, he said, I have been gravely disturbed to learn of the deaths of many of our brave PDF troopers in the ongoing and ruthless attacks perpetrated by the Resistance. Attacks that have also claimed the lives of many innocent civilians.
Bollocks they have, snarled Jeddah. Clan of blood only.
I applaud the vigilance of our troopers and recognize their bravery, Nykron continued. But I also listen when their commanders tell me that the enemy hiding among us is a clear and present danger we have yet to overcome. And so, rather than prolong this terrible fighting and waste more precious Dagonetti lives, I have petitioned for assistance.
What does that mean?
Muttered one of Jeddah's men. Kell kept his expression unchanged, aware that Coyne was watching him closely. Across the chamber, a hush had fallen, as everyone hung on Nykron's words.
Centuries ago, when Dagonet was beneath the shadow of corrupt priest kings, we faced a similar crisis. And then, as now, a warrior came to aid us, a master of war who freed us from fear and terror.
The governor blinked and licked his lips. Kell felt an odd tingle of anticipation in his trigger finger.
Citizens, I have this day received word from the fleet of the Sons of Horus. They are coming to Dagonet to deliver us, and the great hero, Horus Lupercal, will be with them. Have no fear. The retribution of the Astartes will be swift and terrible. But in its wake, the freedom we crave, freedom of liberty, freedom from the stifling rule of a distant and uncaring emperor, will be ours.
Grohl tapped a key on the projector, and the image died.
And there it is.
It was as if something had sucked all the air from the chamber. Nykron's statement had shocked the rebels into silence. Jeddah spoke first.
Astartes, he whispered,
all trace of his earlier elation gone.
Coming here.
He looked to Capra.
We can't fight space marines. Clan troopers are one thing, but the War Master's elite. They're like nothing we've ever seen, Grohl said darkly. Genetically enhanced superhumans, living weapons, angels of death. A handful of them can crush armies.
So what shall we do then?
Snapped By angrily.
Surrender at once. Shoot ourselves and save them the trouble.
They'll destroy us all, Grohl insisted. The only hope we have is to disband our forces and lose ourselves in the general populace. That or flee off-world before their warships arrive.
He glared at Kell.
Because our salvation won't be here before Horus, will it?
He's right, Capra,
said Jeddah, his tone bleak.
Against men, we've got a fighting chance. But we can't beat war gods. They're not gods,
Kell snarled, quieting him.
They are not invulnerable. They bleed red like any one of us. They can die.
He met Grohl's look.
Even Horus.
Capra gave a slow nod.
Cal's right. The Astartes are formidable, but they can be beaten.
He gave the Vindicare a level stare.
Tell me they can be beaten.
I killed a space marine, said Cal.
Coyne's bland expression flickered as something like surprise crossed the other assassin's face. Cal ignored it and went on.
And I'm still here.
Capra!
Groll started to speak again, but the rebel leader waved him into silence.
I need to think on this,
he told them.
Bay, come with me.
Capra walked away with the woman, and Kel watched him go. Groll gave the Vindicare a harsh look and left him, with Jeddah and the other warriors following. Kel picked up the memory spool and weighed it in his hand.
Did you really terminate an Astartes?
Said Coyne.
You know the rules,
Kel replied without looking away.
A clade's targets are its own concern.
The Calidus sniffed.
It doesn't matter. Even if you did, it's just one truth among a handful of pretty lies.
That one, Groll, he's the smartest of all this lot. The sons of Horus will destroy them and turn this world into a funeral pyre along the way. I've seen how the Astartes fight.
Kel rounded on the shade and stepped closer.
The Warmaster is coming here. That's all that matters.
Oh, indeed, said Coyne. And by the time Capra and the other ones who have decided to trust you realize that's all we want, it will be too late.
The other assassin leaned in.
But let me ask you this, Kel. Do you feel any remorse about what we're doing? Do you feel any pity for these people?
The Vindicare looked away.
The Imperium appreciates their sacrifice.
The quarters aboard the Ayuba, belonging to Operative Hissos, were as predictably dull as Spear had expected them to be. There were only a few flashes of individuality here and there. A cabinet with a few bottles of good Amasek, a shelf of paperplast books on a wide variety of subjects, and some rather indifferent pencil sketches that the man had apparently drawn himself. Spear's lip curled at the dead man's pretension. Perhaps he thought he was some kind of warrior poet, standing sentinel over the people of the Urotas clan by day, touching a sensitive artistic soul by night. The truth was nowhere near as dignified, however. Delving through the morass of jumbled memories he had stolen from Hissos's dead brain, Spear found more than enough incidents where the security operative had been called upon to use his detective skills to smooth over situations with native law enforcement on worlds along the Tibian trade axis. The Consortium's crews and officers broke laws on other worlds, and it was Hissos who was forced to find locals to take the blame, or the right men to bribe. He cleaned up messes left by the Void Baron and his family, and on some level, the man had hated himself for it. Spear had extruded a number of eyes and allowed them to wander the room, sweeping for surveillance devices. Finding nothing, he reconsumed them and then rested, letting his outer aspect relax. The fleshy matter coating his body lost a little definition. To an outside observer, it would have looked like an image slipping out of focus through a lens. He sensed a faint call from the demon's skin. It wanted fresh blood, but that it always wanted fresh blood. Spear let some of the remains of Hissos he had kept in his secondary stomach ooze out to be absorbed by the living sheath, and it quieted. He sat at the desk across from the sleeping alcove. Laid out over the surface were a half dozen data slates, each of them displaying layers of information about the Ayuba. There were deck plans and security protocols, conduit diagrams, patrols, servitor routings, even a copy of the Void Baron's daily itinerary. Spear's long, spidery fingers danced over them, plucking slates from the pile for a moment, putting them back, selecting others. A strategy was forming. And the more he gave it his consideration, the more he realized that it would need to be implemented sooner rather than later. The Rogue Trader's flagship had dropped out of the churn of the warp near a neutron star in the Cascade Line, to take sightings and rest the drives before setting off to the rendezvous at Arrowhead. They would be here no more than a day, and once the Ayuba was back in the Immaterium, the energy flux from the vessel's Gellerfield generators would interfere with Spear's plans to break into Eurotas's personal reliquary. The flux had the unfortunate side effect of causing distress to the demon skin, rendering some of its more useful traits ineffectual. It would have to be done soon, then.
No!
Spear flinched, and his whole body rippled with a sudden jolt of pain. The echoing screech lanced through him like a laser.
No, 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 no!
Shut up! He spat, pushing away from the desk, shaking his head.
Shut up!
The voice within tried to cry out again, but he smothered it with a sharp exhale of air and a tensing of his will. For a moment, Spear felt it inside himself, deep down in the black depths of his spirit, the flickering ember of light, a tiny piece of Yosef Sabrat's soul, trapped and furious. The killer dropped to the floor of the room and bowed his head, closed his eyes. He drew inwards, let his thoughts fall into himself. It was akin to sinking into an ocean of dark, heavy oil, but instead of resisting it, Spear allowed himself to be filled by the blackness, relishing the sensation of drowning. He plunged into the void of his own shattered psyche, searching for the foreign, the human, the thought colours of a dead man. It was difficult. The faint echoes of every life he had destroyed and then imitated all still lingered here somewhere. But they'd all been purged through the ritual rites, and what remained was just a shallow imprint, like the shadows burnt on walls by the flash of a nuclear fireball. Something of Yosef Sabrat was still here, though. Something tenacious, that obstinately refused to allow Spear to expunge it, clinging on. And there it was, a glow in the gloom. Spear's animus leapt at it, fangs out, ready to rip it to shreds. The killer found it cloaked in a memory, a moment, a terrible burning pain. He laughed as he realized he was experiencing the instant when he had pierced Sabrat's heart with a bone blade, but this time from the victim's point of view. The pain was blinding and familiar. Spear hesitated. Yes, he knew this feeling, this exact feeling. Sabrat's memory echoed one of his own. A memory from the killer's past. Too late, Spear understood that the fragment had fled his grasp, cleverly cloaking itself in the similarity. And too late, he was dragged into his own past, back to an experience that had made him into the monster he was. Back to the cage. The pain and the cage. Voices outside. The armored warriors moving and speaking, war angels and gun lords, black souls and beasts. Voices. Is this it? A commander master, clear from tone and manner, obeyed. Yes.
Aye, my lord, says the wounded one. A pariah, according to the logs left by the Silent Sisterhood. But I've not seen the like, and they didn't know what it was either. It was bound for destruction, most likely.
The master to be his master comes closer. He sees a face filled with wonderment and hatred. I smell the witch stink on it. It did not die with the rest of the crew and cargo.
Well, the Emperor's black ships are resilient vessels. Some were bound to live beyond our bombardment.
A pause, during which he takes some sharp breaths, trying to listen to the voices. Tell me what it did. A sigh, weary and fearful.
I was attacked. It took a finger from me. With its teeth.
Mocking laughter. And you let it live?
I would have destroyed it, Lord. But then it killed the Codicea, Brother Sadron.
Laughter stopped now, anger colouring.
How? Well, Sadron lost an ear to it, eaten, swallowed whole. Then the witch stood there and waited to be killed. Sadran...
The wounded one is finding it hard to explain.
Sadran turned his fury on the thing, and it
reflected it back.
Reflected?
The master voice, different again, interested.
Fires, Lord! Sadran was consumed by his own fires!
The shapes move around in the shadows beyond the cage bars. I've never encountered a pariah capable of that. The master comes close, and he has his first real look at it. You're something special, aren't you?
It may be a fluke birth, says the injured one, or perhaps some throwback from the experimentations of the Adeptus Telepathica.
A smile grows wide in the gloom. It may also be an opportunity. He presses up towards the bars, allowing himself to reach the ethereal edges of his senses towards the Commander Master.
We should kill it, says the other voice.
I'll be the judge of that. He touches a mind, and for the first time in his life finds something that is darker than himself. A Stygian soul, steeped in blackness, initiated into realms beyond his ability to know.
My Lord Erebus!
The injured one tries to argue, but the master silences him with a look. These are your orders, brother captain, says the dark-hearted one. Remove all trace that we were ever here, and ensure that this vessel becomes lost to the void. I will gather what we came for, and bring our new friend here into the bargain. The one called Erebus smiles again. I think we will have use for him. As the other warrior departs, the master leans in. Do you have a name? He asks. It has been a long time since he has spoken, and it takes a moment to form the word, but finally he manages.
Spear!
Erebus nods. Your first lesson, then. I am your master. Then the warrior is a blur, and there is a blade in his hand, and then the blade is in Spear's chest, and the pain is blinding, burning. I am your master, Erebus says once again, and from now on, you will kill only who I tell you to kill. Spear reels back. He nods, giving his fealty. The pain fills him, fills the cage. The pain and the cage. The moment snapped like brittle glass, and Spear jerked upright, his foot kicking out and knocking over a chair. He scrambled to his feet, catching sight of his face in a mirror. Hissos's aspect was pasty, like unfired clay. He grimaced and tried to concentrate, but the encounter with the memory fragment and the flash of his past had cut to his core. He was breathing hard, the demon skin on his hands rippling crimson. Operative! Someone was knocking on his cabin door. I heard a cry. Are you all right in there?
I'm fine,
he shouted back.
I fell from my bed. It's nothing.
Are you sure? He recognized the voice now. It was one of the duty officers on this deck.
Go away,
he snapped.
Aye, sir,
said the officer after a moment, and he heard footsteps recede. Spear walked to the mirror and glared at Hissos's face as it resurfaced.
You can't stop me,
he told the reflection.
None of you can.
None of you.
In recognition of their help, the rebels had given all the members of the execution force quarters in one of the smaller chambers off the main corridor. The rooms were no bigger than holding cells, but they were dry and they had privacy, which was more than could be said for many of the communal sleeping areas. Solm didn't knock and wait outside her brother's compartment. Instead, she slammed the corroded metal door open and stormed into the room. He looked up from the makeshift table before him, where the disassembled components of his long rifle lay like an exploded technical diagram. Lines of bullets were arranged in rows like tiny sentries on a parade ground. He stopped himself from drawing his Exitus pistol and returned to the work of cleaning his firearm.
Where are your manners, Jenica?
He said. She closed the door and folded her arms.
We're doing this, then, she said. We're actually going to sacrifice all these people just to complete the mission.
What was your first clue? He asked.
Was it when I told you that was our plan on board the Ultio? Or when Valdor made it exactly, precisely clear what our objective was?
You're manipulating Capra and his people, she insisted.
This is what we do, said her brother. Don't pretend you've never done the same thing to get close to a mark. Lied and cheated.
I've never put innocence in harm's way. The whole motive of the Officio Assassinorum is to move sightless and unseen, leave no trace but the corpse of our target. But you're cutting a road of blood for us to follow.
This isn't the Great Crusade anymore, dear sister.
He put down his tools and studied her.
Are you so naive that you don't see that? We're not thinning the ranks of a few degenerate bohemian fops in the halls of some hive world, or terminating a troublesome Xenos commander. We are on the front lines of a civil war. The rules of engagement are very different now.
Solm was quiet for a moment. It had been many years since she had seen Aristide, and it made her sad to see how he had changed. She could only see the worst of him behind those dark eyes.
It's not just the resistance fighters whose lives we are threatening. By keeping this conflict alive, we will doom countless innocent people, perhaps even threaten the future of this entire planet and the sector beyond.
Are you asking me if the death of Horus Lupercal is worth that price? Well, that's a question you should put to Valdor, or the Master of Assassins. I'm only doing what I was ordered to. Our duty is all that matters.
She felt a surge of emotion in her chest and crushed it before it could become a snarl or a sob.
How can you be so cold-blooded, Aristide? We are supposed to protect the people of the Imperium, not offer them up as fodder for the cannons.
Solm shook her head.
I don't know who you are.
With a flash of anger, her brother bolted to his feet.
You don't know me. I'm not the one who rejected her own name. I didn't turn my back on justice.
Is that what you tell yourself?
She looked away.
We both had a choice all those years ago, Aristide. Escape or revenge. But you chose revenge, and you condemned us to a life where we are nothing but killers.
The memory came back to her in a giddy rush. They were both just children then, the scions of their family, the last surviving members of the Kell dynasty, their holdings destroyed and their parents exterminated during an internecine struggle among the aristocrats of the Thaxted duchy. Orphaned and alone, they had been drawn into the halls of the Imperial Schola, and there both secretly selected by agents of the Officio Assassinorum. Brother and sister had shown promise. Aristide was an excellent marksman for one so young, and Jenica's genius for botany and chemistry was clear. They knew that soon the clade directors would make their decisions, and that they would be split up, perhaps never to see one another again. In the halls of the Schola, they had made their plans to flee together, to eschew the assassin's path and find a new life. But then, Clade Vindicare offered something that Aristide Kell wanted more than his freedom, the chance to avenge his mother and father. All they asked for in return was his loyalty. And, consumed by hate, he gave it willingly. Jenica had been left behind with nowhere to go but to the open arms of the Veninum. Months later, she had learned that innocents had been killed in the hit on the man who murdered their parents, and that had been the day when she swore she would no longer go by the name of Kell again.
"I'd hoped you might have changed since I last saw you," she said. "And you have. But not for the better."
Her brother seemed as if he was on the verge of an outburst, but then he drew it back in and looked away.
"You're right," he told her. "You don't know me. Now get out."
"As you command," Solm said stiffly.